June 27, 1977. Elizabeth Congdon, heir to a copper and iron ore fortune, is murdered in the family mansion in Duluth, Minnesota. Also murdered, her unsuspecting night nurse. What happened after is a mystery many think is solved, but is it? The real question is, how far will a family member go to acquire money? This is the mysterious homicide at Glensheen. Family fortune, greed, and murder. Hey y'all, I'm Chris Calvert.
And I'm her husband, Rob Potter. Welcome to Hitch to Homicide.
For better or worse.
Till death do us part.
Back, everybody.
Yes, welcome, welcome, welcome. And for our friends in Albania.
Okay.
Here we go. Imi ripritur, imi ripritur, imi ripritur.
Very nice.
There you go.
Welcome, Albania.
I hope I was close.
Well, wherever you're listening, be sure to like, rate, and review. Be sure to subscribe as well.
Yes.
We appreciate all your comments and emails so much.
Yes, we do.
In fact, this case was sent to us by a listener, Stacy Tom. Thank you very much for sending it in. I'd never heard of this case.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you, Stacy. I started looking into it and I was like, I'm going to do that one because I like doing the weird ones in October.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And speaking of listeners, just like Stacy, be sure to go to Facebook. You can find us. We're the H2H In-Laws and Outlaws. Mm-hmm. That's our closed Facebook group. It's our safe space for true crime.
for the true crime wackies.
Come join in the fun.
We love it.
Before we get started today, let me thank some sources. The Minneapolis Star, Tribune, Justia Law, Wikipedia, Artful Living, ZenithCity.com, and Twin Cities PBS. There are a couple of books out there. I did not read them, but I will put a link to them in the show notes. Glenn Sheen's Daughter by Sharon Darby Hendry and Secrets of the Condon Mansion by Joe Kimball.
All right. Well, you ready?
I am.
Let's do it.
The Congdon family was put on the map in the United States by Chester Adgate Congdon.
Chester.
Chester is born on June 12, 1853 in Rochester, New York. On his father's side, Chester is sixth in descent from James Congdon, a Quaker from England who settled in Rhode Island in the 17th century.
Okay.
Chester went to public schools. He grew up and went to college at Syracuse University, where he graduated in 1875 with a Bachelor of Arts degree.
Nice.
He studied law under the preceptorship of Hiscock, Gifford, and Doheny. We know a few Doheny's.
Yeah, we know a couple of those.
In 1877, Chester is admitted to the New York Bar. And after this, he teaches school for about a year in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
Chippewa.
And the only thing I can think of about Chippewa Falls is in Titanic. Isn't that where?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that where Leonardo DiCaprio's character's from?
Yeah.
Chippewa Falls.
Yeah.
Sounds so like down home. Like you want to go get a good casserole in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But then he moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, where he was admitted to the bar there, and he started a law practice. Now, Chester marries Clara Hesperia Bannister in 1881 in Syracuse, New York. Clara's father is a minister.
Is it me or do names seem a little bit more easier to pronounce these days?
Well, I mean, they liked family names.
Yeah.
So they used a lot of family names as like middle names. I mean, listen, one of my best friends in the world, she's an attorney. We went to college together. I mean, her middle name is Wiss, and we've never called her anything but Mary Wiss.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's, I just think that's an old family way of doing things.
Right.
Yeah. I'm Kristen. I don't look like a Kristen. I don't feel like I've ever acted like a Kristen. I'm a Chris.
Yeah.
So I've always been Chris. Or Chrissy. Yeah. If you're part of the family.
Or Robbie.
Or Robbie. I do call him Robbie. That's true. That's true. But like I said before, Claire's dad is a minister. These two are going to get married and have 7 children.
Wow.
And they're even going to adopt the son of Clara's brother, her nephew, Alfred Bannister.
Okay.
The children were Walter Edward, Marjorie Helen, John, Elizabeth, and Robert.
Okay.
Now, the youngest daughter, Elizabeth Mannering Congdon, is born on April 22nd, 1894. Her father, Chester, meets and becomes business partners with Henry Olive of Pittsburgh, and together, Chester and Henry form a mining company, mining iron ore.
Okay.
Chester is part of an exclusive group in the United States at the time. J.D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, along with Chester and his partner Henry, and they start to battle over the ore rights on the Mesabi Iron Range in northern Minnesota.
Okay.
That is until J.P. Morgan comes along and forms U.S. Steel and just buys everybody out.
Yep.
Then Chester goes into copper mining in Arizona. And when Minnesota wanted to place taxes on tonnage of iron shipped out of the state, Chester runs for the 51st district in Minnesota and wins. If he can't make things happen outside of the state house, he's going to go inside the state house.
Yeah, make it happen from there.
But for the last few years, Chester has been building a home for his very large family.
Okay.
Construction started in 1905 and was completed in 1908.
Wow.
At a total cost of $854,000, or in today's money, $29.8 million.
How big was this place?
I'm about to tell you all about it.
Okay.
Chester named it Glen Sheen, which means shining glen, and was named for Chester's ancestral home in Surrey, England.
Okay.
It's a 39-room Jacobean mansion that sits on 12 acres in Duluth, Minnesota, right on Lake Superior.
Wow.
Now, inside the house, there are rules. Clara's dad was a minister, remember?
Sure.
No smoking, no drinking.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if Clara ever went into the smoking room where Chester and his buddies would hang out.
Right.
All of the children go off to college, including the youngest daughter, Elizabeth, who's studying at Wellesley. Then on November 21st, 1916, Chester dies of a pulmonary embolism. Mm. He is 63 years old.
Wow.
Now, all the other sons and daughters are married, and Alfred, the adopted brother, is studying at MIT. Elizabeth drops out of Wellesley and comes home to be with her mother.
Okay.
I also read that Alfred stayed at Glen Sheen for the most part of the 1920s. But the point I wanted to make is that everyone had a life full of marriage and children, and Elizabeth stays at Glen Sheen with her mom.
Gotcha.
But Elizabeth, even though she isn't married, she wants children. So Elizabeth adopts 2 daughters.
Okay.
The first is born on July 14th, 1932 in Tarboro, North Carolina. Her birth name is Jacqueline Barnes. Hmm. Her mother was a single, unwed girl. Elizabeth adopted the little girl in October of 1932 and changed her name to Marjorie after her older sister.
Oh.
Then in August of 1935, Elizabeth adopts a second little girl and names her Jennifer. Now, during those early years, it was just Clara the mom, Elizabeth, and her 2 adopted daughters. The girls both attend Dana Hall School in Massachusetts, so they're sent away to boarding school. The younger sister, Jennifer, thrives, but Marjorie's a little bit of a problem. She liked to steal from stores, even though she had whatever she wanted.
Yeah.
Or whatever she needed.
Wow.
Yeah. Her mother, Elizabeth, would always take care of it, and it was always kept out of the newspapers. But Marjorie also liked to start fires.
Oh, jeez.
She's a kleptomaniac and a pyromaniac.
Wow.
Yeah.
She's got all the maniacs covered.
Yeah, I mean, this is a kid who had everything. I even read in one of the old newspaper articles that she and her mother spent 3 months in Europe, and they visited like 12 countries or something. And I mean, she's led a life of privilege. But she likes to steal, and she likes to set fires.
Everybody's got to have a hobby, I guess.
Everybody's got to have a hobby. In 1949, at the age of 17, Marjorie is diagnosed at the Miniger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, as a sociopath.
Wow.
So she consistently shows no regard for right or wrong, and she ignores the rights and feelings of others.
Gee whiz.
So she's doing whatever she wants, and she doesn't care who it affects.
Yeah.
A year later, on July 12, 1950, Chester's wife Clara passes away at the age of 96.
Wow.
Now, by this time, the Congdon family has given so much to the community of Duluth, Minnesota. There's a Congdon Park, a Congdon Boulevard, and even a Congdon School.
Hey, let me go back just for a second. When did her mother die?
1950.
Yeah, I mean, 96. That even in 1950.
That's a long life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she was born in the late 1800s.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
96.
Good genes.
Good genes, good living.
Yeah.
She had the best of everything.
True.
And I think that, you know, that makes a difference.
True.
But at the age of 19, Marjorie marries a man named Richard Leroy at Glensheen Manor. And although Marjorie and her sister aren't close, to make their mom happy, these two stand as maids of honor for their weddings.
All right.
Richard is an accountant. They move to Minneapolis. And over the next 20 years of marriage, Marjorie and Richard will have 7 children.
Wow.
This is a prolific crew.
Yeah.
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 But even though Richard was a successful accountant, mm-hmm. and Marjorie has a trust fund, Marjorie doesn't have enough money for all of her excessive spending.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She liked the kids to have all these matching outfits, and they had dozens of boots and skates, and her kids were big into ice skating competitions, and horses and horse shows, neither of which are cheap.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, I was a dance mom. We were dance parents.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Just go throw money out the window for dance competition.
Exactly.
And all the travel. And, you know, the same thing with, you know, traveling baseball and traveling lacrosse. We did all of those things.
Yep.
We wouldn't trade it for the world. But let me tell you, they're all expensive.
We had our eye on a loaf of bread every once in a while. Just kidding.
That's right. Kids in school, paying for everything.
Yep.
They turned out okay.
They did.
We'll take them. They turned out okay.
Yep.
But there's another ice skating family that Marjorie is close to. The Hagen family, Wally and Helen. That's called foreshadowing.
Uh-oh.
Exactly. But because Marjorie's always needing money, she goes to her mom a lot for money. A lot. And, you know, when kids are younger, you know, in their 20s, sometimes after they're out of school, sometimes they come to their parents and say, hey, I need new tires.
Yeah.
I need a loan.
Yep.
I'll pay you back next week. That kind of thing.
Yep.
But she's been married for 20 years.
Wow.
And she's still asking her mom for money.
Wow.
Finally, Marjorie and Richard divorce. Richard's tired of trying to keep up with Marjorie's spending.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So they part in 1971.
Okay.
Then in November of 1973, during a family reunion, Marjorie shows up and she brings with her some homemade marmalade.
Hmm.
And she feeds it to her mother and only her mother. Like, hey, mom, this is like homemade marmalade kind of thing. Here, try this.
Mm.
And afterwards, Elizabeth was deathly ill, and her family thought she's been poisoned.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was a tranquilizer.
Whoa.
And other members of the family are like, we saw Marjorie feeding Elizabeth marmalade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Soon after, Marjorie moved to Colorado looking for a fresh start. Marjorie meets her next husband, Roger Caldwell, in 1975 at a Parents Without Partners meeting.
That was before Match.com.
Before Match.com. I think they still have Parents Without Partners.
Do they?
I think so. Okay. Yeah. Somebody can email me and tell me if I'm wrong.
Right.
But Marjorie had just loads of personality. She was so bubbly and funny. And I read that in counter to that, Roger was available and malleable.
What do you want me to be?
Roger's a sitting duck.
Yeah.
Roger and Marjorie soon tie the knot in March of 1976. But a leopard doesn't change its spots, and Marjorie doesn't stop spending. Mm. She keeps buying extravagant clothing for herself and the children, and she's even cleaned out her million-dollar trust fund.
Wow.
Because I saw in one video, there's this reporter, Joe Kimball, who covered this case from, like, start to finish. He started when he was a really young kid working at the newspaper. And I saw this video where he's giving a talk in Minnesota, and he talked about the fact that she was supposed to be living off the interest. Like, she got an allowance out of that trust fund.
Yeah.
And somehow, she got somebody to sign off on letting her have the whole thing.
Jeez.
And when she has gone through that $1 million, she starts bouncing checks. And remember, this is 1973, 74, 75. That's a ton of money.
Yeah, I was about ready to say in 1970s, $1 million.
That was a lot.
That was a ton of dough.
That was a lot.
Yeah.
But she spends it all. Then she starts bouncing checks, and she thinks her mom is going to pay her bills because her mom has always come to her aid.
Yeah.
Her mother, Elizabeth, was a little bit of an enabler.
Okay.
Yeah. She's trying to keep her from getting into trouble, and I think she's just trying to keep the family name out of the newspaper.
Sure.
But in 1976, Elizabeth, Marjorie's mother, has a stroke. Mm. She's paralyzed on one side of her body. Now, remember, Elizabeth has never married, and she's the sole person who lives in Glensheen.
Right.
She lives in the Congdon Mansion by herself with a staff.
Okay.
Now, in 1968, the trustees and the family decided to donate Glensheen to the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
But Elizabeth is allowed to live there until the end of her life.
So is the university covering all the costs?
No. The family still owns it. They've gifted it.
Okay.
And when she's gone.
But who's paying for the staff and all that stuff?
The Congdon family.
Okay.
Yeah. The Congdon family is still paying for the staff as long as she's there.
Gotcha.
But when she passes away, the house goes to the mansion and the 39 acres go to the University of Minnesota. And to this day, that's who owns it.
Okay.
Now, by the spring of 1977, Roger and Marjorie are dead-ass broke. Their home has been foreclosed.
Wow.
Their cars were repossessed. And they still went out with a real estate agent looking at multi-million-dollar ranches in Colorado, telling the agent, my mom is going to handle this for me.
Okay.
Marjorie keeps telling everybody her youngest son needed the mountain air for his asthma. Hmm. Now, there's even one story that Elizabeth's nurses saw Marjorie come visit her mother and used her mom's hand to sign a check for $20,000. This
really?
Is after she's had the stroke.
Wow.
And the nurses report this to the Congdon trustees.
Oh, wow. Good.
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody trusts Marjorie.
You think?
I mean, everybody kind of knows, you know, even as a kid, she's a little bit of a bad penny, right?
A little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Still, Marjorie goes back to her mom for money, but after her mother's stroke and her need for round-the-clock care, the Congdon trustees step in and they say, Marjorie, no more.
Back off, Jack.
So Roger and Marjorie are flat broke. Hmm. And I even saw where they were so broke, they were using slugs in a soft drink machine.
Gee whiz.
And if you don't know what a slug is, it's a fake coin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's broke broke.
Yeah.
That's beyond broke.
That's pretty broke.
Yeah.
Then on June 22nd, 1977, Marjorie writes a handwritten will and has it notarized.
Okay.
In the will, she promises her husband, Roger, $2.5 million of her $8 million inheritance after her mother is dead.
Uh-oh. Let me do this.
Something's afoot at the Circle K.
It is.
Yeah.
Oh.
Only 3 nights later, Marjorie's mother is asleep in her bedroom on the Glensheen Mansion's second floor.
Okay.
Across the hallway, the night nurse, Velma Petilla, I hope I got your name right, Velma, she's making her final checks on Elizabeth. Velma wasn't the usual night nurse. In fact, she had been Elizabeth's day nurse for years, and she and Elizabeth were really close. Mm. But Velma had just retired the month before because she wanted to play more golf and she wanted to visit with her grandchildren.
Okay.
But on this night, she's filling in because the other night nurse wanted the night off and no one else could fill in. Nobody else could take the shift.
Okay.
So Velma comes back just for the night.
Right.
And interestingly enough, her husband, he did not want her to take this night shift. He didn't like her working at night. Mm. Now, from this point on, everything that happens is a little bit of a mystery. At some point in the night, the killer came into Glen Sheen Mansion. Police will later find a broken window in the billiard room on the first floor of the house, but the killer might have come through the front door. Mm. In the middle of the night, this killer goes upstairs to the bedroom level. Velma hears him, stops him on the landing of the grand staircase. I'm using him, not knowing if it's a him or a her. I'll let you figure that out.
Okay.
She confronts him. She fights with him. He punches her in the face. And as she's clawing and fighting him, he picks up a brass candlestick holder and beats her with it until she is quiet.
Wow.
He beats her until she's dead.
Wow.
Then in Elizabeth's room, he holds a pillow covered in a silk case over her face until she's dead, which takes about 5 minutes.
Gee whiz.
This happens for 5 minutes until she's no longer struggling. Now, remember, she's had a stroke, so she can't fight anybody off.
Right.
Then he rummaged through a closet and her nightstand. He takes some jewelry. He puts it in a basket. Then he takes a diamond ring from Elizabeth's finger and a gold watch from her wrist. Wow. But before he goes, he takes a gold Byzantine coin from Elizabeth's dresser.
Okay.
He is covered in blood from Velma, so he washes his hands and his face in the small bathroom across the hall from the bedroom, and he leaves blood in the bathroom, but no fingerprints. Mm. Then the killer rummages through Velma's purse, finds her car keys, goes out the front door, leaving it unlocked, and drives away.
Okay.
The next morning, the day nurse, Mildred Garview, arrives for work at 7 a.m., and she's really surprised because the front door is unlocked. Or as we say in our house, you left that wide open, which doesn't mean that it's open. It just means it's unlocked.
Yep.
You left that door wide open. She stops first in the kitchen to see the cook. Then she starts up the stairs and she sees Velma like lying on the window seat at the landing of this grand staircase. Mm. And at first Mildred's like, is Velma asleep in the window seat?
Yeah.
But as she gets closer, she realizes that there's blood all over the wall and that Velma is dead.
Wow.
Then she rushes into Elizabeth's room. The pillow is still on Elizabeth's face. Mm. She sees that the room's been sort of pilfered through. There's jewelry on the floor. She rushes downstairs and calls 911. She and the cook are thinking the killer might still be in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So they stay on the line with them until the police arrive and they can go through the house room by room.
Right.
Now, 3 days later, all of Elizabeth's family shows up to get ready for the funeral, including Roger and Marjorie. Mm. Roger has cuts and bruises on his face and hands, and his right hand is swollen. Marjorie tells the family that Roger was kicked by a horse.
Yeah, okay.
Now, police know from Velma's body that she was punched in the face, and when police see Roger, and they see Roger's hands, they shake it and squeeze it really tight on purpose because they want to see if he's going to wince.
Right.
And guess what?
He winces.
He did.
Yeah.
And you have to know that in a family where there's so much money and so much power, the police are looking at the family for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So they cover all the usual stuff and they run with the idea that it's a botched burglary. But behind the scenes, they're looking into Marjorie because the family rolls into town and they tell police, look it, Marjorie's broke.
Yeah.
She's a little crazy. Mm-hmm. She has this new husband. Everything's been repossessed. We think you should look into her and Roger. And oh, by the way, we think Marjorie tried to kill Elizabeth with her marmalade laced with Trenks.
Yeah.
So the Duluth police know We can't mess this up.
Right.
This is a prominent family. This is a murder at Glen Sheen.
Yep.
This is Elizabeth Congdon.
Yep.
So blood and hair are gathered at the scene of the crime, but there weren't any fingerprints. And remember, it's 1977, so we're years away from DNA.
Sure.
But the police know Marjorie and Roger flew in from Colorado to Duluth to ask for $750,000 to buy a ranch because the trustees were the ones who handled the conversation and said, no dice.
Yeah.
You're getting nothing.
You're getting squat.
But Roger also told the trustees that if they wouldn't give him $750,000, they needed to at least give him $500,000 to pay off their debts and to stay out of jail.
Wow.
$500,000 in debts in 1977.
That's crazy.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But they got bupkis. They got nothing. They left Duluth with nothing.
Wow.
So police go to Colorado, where Roger and Marjorie live. And while Roger and Marjorie are in Duluth to mourn the murder of her mother, police discover an envelope in Roger and Marjorie's Colorado mailbox.
Uh-oh.
It was written in Roger's handwriting.
Yeah.
And Golden, Colorado was misspelled.
Really?
Golden was spelled with an A.
Okay.
And inside the envelope was a Byzantine coin, just like the one taken from Elizabeth's bedroom.
Really?
Yep.
Not too smart, Roger.
Nope.
Wow.
They dusted the envelope for prints, and a fingerprint expert said there's one print and it matches Roger.
Mm.
And the envelope was postmarked in Duluth the day of the murders.
Wow.
The hair found at the house closely matched Roger's, and some of the blood matched Roger's blood type. Again, remember, they can be like, well, this looks like the same color hair as Roger.
Right.
And the blood type does match Roger.
Sure.
But that's not DNA.
Right.
When they search Roger and Marjorie's hotel room right after the murders, that's right. Remember, their house has been foreclosed on. They're living in a hotel.
Jeez.
They find in their room jewelry that was extremely familiar to what was stolen from Elizabeth's room.
Wow.
But Marjorie says, Mom and I owned lots of jewelry that was identical. And I read that and I thought,
Yeah.
But my sister and I and my mom, my late mom, we all had jewelry that was identical.
Hmm.
We've all had the same piece of jewelry.
Okay.
So that's plausible. That's possible.
Sure.
Velma's car, the nurse who's murdered, her car is found at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport the day after the murders. So whoever killed and took the car took off on a plane.
God, these two aren't very bright.
Oh, it gets better.
Okay.
In a garbage can at the airport, maintenance workers found the keys and a parking ticket with a timestamp of 6:35 a.m., which is enough time for the killer to make the 150-mile drive from Duluth after the crime to the airport. Now, while searching the Caldwell's room, Marjorie and Roger's room, police find a receipt from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport gift shop for a suit bag bought the morning of the murders. And Roger actually owned such a bag.
Wow.
Then they show a picture of Roger to two gift shop workers, and they're like, he might have been the buyer.
Yeah.
Because remember, again, there's no CCTV.
Sure.
So police are like, okay, this looks, it's hinky,
yeah,
and we know probably what's happened, but they don't have any real hard evidence. It's all circumstantial.
Sure.
But the prosecutor, John DeSanto, thinks this is enough to at least charge him.
Right.
So she and Velma, the nurse, are murdered on June 27th. And on July 5th, Roger is arrested. And on July 8th, Roger is charged with two counts of first-degree murder.
Wow.
Now, Roger's attorney doesn't think he'll get a fair trial in Duluth. Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
So they move the trial to Brainerd. And jury selection begins in April of 1978. The trial lasted 3 weeks, but there's some problems for the prosecution. Police couldn't identify two handprints found in the bathroom where the killer washed up. They weren't Roger's.
Okay.
And his defense tells the jury those prints belong to the real killer. They also had to dismiss a juror because they'd been offered $10,000 to find Roger guilty.
Really?
Yeah, nobody knows where that the offer came from,
right.
And they just sort of let that go. And it made me think, I wonder if somebody in Elizabeth's family was like, I want to make sure this guy goes to jail.
Right.
I'll give you 10 grand.
Yep.
Also, there's this problem. Nobody saw Roger in Duluth on the day of the murders, and they couldn't find him on any passenger list on a plane. Now, remember, it's not like the manifest is now where they know everything about you.
They know the size of your Fruit of the Looms.
Yeah, and if you're TSA pre-check, they got your fingerprints. They got everything.
Yeah.
But they didn't know, and they didn't have an explanation for the coin Roger sent to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the defense showed that Roger's arm wouldn't fit through the broken glass in the billiard room. And it made me think of the glove. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Yeah. So they had like a cardboard cutout of the broken glass in the billiard room and what it was. And then Roger couldn't fit his arm through it.
But didn't they say that the front door
was wide open?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And who might have keys to the house?
Huh, let me think.
Family members.
Yeah.
Roger didn't testify, and honestly, as you have already said, he is not the brightest crayon in the box. When it was all said and done, 500 pieces of evidence were shown and 109 witnesses took the stand. The jury deliberated for 2.5 days and found him, you want to take a guess?
No idea.
Guilty of murder one and sentenced him to 2 consecutive life sentences with a minimum of 35 years behind bars.
Wow.
This conviction gave John DeSanto, the prosecutor, confidence to go after Marjorie.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything on her per se, but they knew there's no way that Roger masterminded anything.
Yeah. Roger can barely mastermind going to the bathroom.
They think it's Marjorie.
Yeah.
And they don't want to charge her with the murder, but with the planning of the murders.
Accessory.
Now, again, it's all circumstantial because people saw her in Colorado on the day of the murders. She's 800 miles away.
Sure.
But no one seemed to think that Roger was capable of planning or doing any of this on his own. He didn't know Glen Sheen Manor. He didn't really know his way around.
Right.
But Marjorie did. Mm. She grew up there. Marjorie hires a man named Ron Meshbesher, and I guess they called him Mesh.
Okay.
He's a defense attorney, a guy who's really good at getting guilty people off.
Okay.
Marjorie's trial was moved to Hastings, also moved out of Duluth. Mm-hmm. Meshbesher found an expert who would say that the fingerprint on the envelope was not Roger's. And they found a witness in Colorado who said she'd actually seen Roger in Golden that day.
Hmm.
She saw him in Golden, Colorado that day.
Really?
And then there's Marjorie. Marjorie sits at this table during this trial, okay? She's knitting.
Wow.
She knits during this trial.
Okay.
Yeah. She knits the whole time.
I'm thinking if I were being accused of being an accessory to murder.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be knitting.
If she wasn't knitting, she had a book nearby. She was always smiling. She was charming. She spoke with reporters. And during the breaks, she would like smile at the jurors as they were coming in and out.
It's like the musical Chicago.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Then on her attorney, Ron Meshbesher's birthday, Marjorie made a birthday cake. And she offered it up to the prosecution, John DeSanto. She was like, here, John, would you like some birthday cake?
Oh,
and when he says, no, thank you, Marjorie says, don't worry. I didn't put any marmalade in it.
Oh, my. What?
Yeah.
She whiz. She's got some stones.
Yeah. Marjorie's got balls, man.
Man.
Marjorie's defense was that somebody else committed the murders and Marjorie and Roger were framed, or at the very least, Roger had done this all on his own.
Yeah.
The jury deliberated for 10 hours and found her not guilty.
Ugh, jeez.
They liked her so much that when the jury decided to get together and like have a little party after everything is over.
Tell me they did invite her.
They invited Marjorie.
Oh, man. Wow.
And because of everything that happened in Marjorie's trial, Roger's attorney files an appeal. And in August of 1982, the Minnesota Supreme Court overturns Rogers' conviction.
What?
And they order that he has a new trial. Because remember, her attorney, Meshbesher, comes in and says, here's our expert. This is not Rogers' fingerprint.
Yeah.
And they are being framed.
Wow.
Now, it's important to know that while Roger is in prison from 1978 to 1982, Marjorie visited him once. She visits him one time in more than 5 years, in over 5 years.
Because that's true love right there.
Till death do us part.
God.
But in Duluth, they know this. There's going to be a new trial, and this is going to be a problem because witnesses are gone. Some are dead.
Yeah.
They let Roger out, and he goes back to Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where he was actually from, mm-hmm. and he's waiting for his new trial.
Okay.
But since they don't think they have a case, they decide they're going to strike a plea with Roger. If he would confess, they would give him just one more year in prison. And he's like, no, I might not be the brightest crayon in the box, but I'm out right now. Yeah. And I'm not going to confess and go back for another year.
Yeah.
So they offer him time served if he would plead guilty and sign a confession.
Okay.
And Roger says,
no.
Okay.
Oh, he does.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm done. Time served. I'm finished. I also read where this was all planned out and done like either on a Friday afternoon or a Saturday morning of a long holiday weekend.
Okay.
So nobody was really around and the newspapers weren't really there to report on it. So people could be just outraged over the whole thing. They just sort of like slipped it all in, right?
Watch this hand over here while we do this over here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit like Congress or whatever, you know, in the middle of the night on, 2 a.m. they pass this bill. Right.
Yeah.
So on July 5th, 1983, Roger gives a confession. He said that he was drunk, that he waited outside the mansion, broke in and killed Elizabeth and Velma. He said he couldn't remember much because he was so wasted and he didn't have a plan. And even though Marjorie couldn't be tried again, double jeopardy, he still didn't implicate Marjorie, the woman who only came to see him one time in prison. Now, in 1981, after her acquittal, Marjorie marries Wally Hagen in a North Dakota civil ceremony. Problem is, she's still married to Roger.
Yeah, I was going to say, did she divorce him or?
Nope, not yet.
Wow.
But Marjorie had known Wally and his wife, Helen, from their kids when they were skating competitively together.
Okay.
And not long after Marjorie is found not guilty, Helen, Wally's wife, is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she's put into a nursing home. Mm. Then just days after she arrives there, Helen lapses into a coma, and 3 days later, she dies. Mm. The last person seen with Helen before she goes into a coma?
Marjorie. Yeah, gee whiz.
And soon after, Marjorie and Wally are inseparable, and after they're married, a house that they had just sold in Minneapolis, St. Paul, burned to the ground on the night they moved out. Now, I read where she didn't want to sell this house. She loved this house, but they sold it anyway. And on the night they moved out, goes up in flames.
Wow.
Marjorie still owed money on this mortgage. And in January of 1984, Marjorie was found guilty of arson and sentenced to 21 months in Shakopee Women's Prison.
Wow.
And Roger wasn't doing very well by this time. He was really overweight. He was an alcoholic. He was really drinking himself to death. He was living off of welfare. Mm. And in 1988, Roger actually committed suicide by cutting his wrists with a steak knife.
Ooh, wow.
He left a suicide note saying, I didn't kill Velma and Elizabeth.
Hmm. So the whole being kicked by the horse and all that they bought. Okay. Whatever, Roger.
Hang on, because eventually, DNA is a thing.
Oh.
So hang on.
Okay, all right.
But in his suicide note, he says, I didn't kill him.
Yeah.
But back to Marjorie. Police uncover these other fires that Marjorie set when she was growing up. And her attorney, Ron Meshbesher, couldn't get her off this time.
Yeah.
And that's why she was convicted to those 21 months in the women's prison.
All right.
But only 20 months later, she's out and she and Wally moved to Arizona. They lived in an RV close to the Mexican border. Now, by this time, Wally has cancer, and she tells people they were going to Mexico to buy drugs for his cancer.
Okay.
But soon after they moved there, these empty houses and garages around them began catching on fire.
Oh, no.
Police think it's a bunch of kids until Marjorie starts fighting with her next-door neighbor, a guy who worked for the Border Patrol.
Okay.
She accuses him of throwing garbage in her yard and of agitating her dog. Just makes me think of all, like, the Karen fights. Sorry if your name's Karen.
Yeah.
All the fights that show up online where you see, like, two people fighting and everybody's like, you know, yeah. I'm filming you, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Marjorie would have been all over that.
Wow.
But one night, this Border Patrol agent, the next-door neighbor, he sees a bottle with a rag hanging out of it sitting on one of his windowsills.
Good Lord.
And he calls the police, and they stake it out because they've had all these fires happen.
Yeah.
And they're waiting for kids to show up. But kids didn't show up.
Let me guess who showed up.
Somebody comes in and lights it, turns and runs away. The police chase after them. It's Marjorie.
Yeah. Yeah. Surprise.
So back to prison she goes. This sentence was for 15 years.
Wow.
But after she's sentenced, she asks the court for one day. One day to move her very ill husband, Wally, into an assisted living facility.
Right.
And in that one day, she manages to kill him.
Wow.
Well, you decide, because here's what happened.
Okay.
They're watching her like a hawk because they're thinking she lives really close to the Mexican border. Yeah. She might just like make a run for it.
It's a flight risk.
Yeah. But the next day, the day they give her, an officer smells natural gas coming from her house because they're staking her out. Mm-hmm. He knocks on the door. Marjorie says, oh, it's all fine. The pilot light had blown out on the stove. And then a few hours later, she called friends to tell them Wally is dead. Police find a piece of hose cut just long enough to reach from the oven to the bedroom.
Gee whiz.
Prescription pills were right near Wally's body, along with a double suicide note saying that she had been unjustly accused and didn't want to go to prison, and that Wally's health meant that he couldn't live without her. And they wished to be buried together in one casket along with their dog. Quote, as we have only the three of us in life, we wish to have the three of ourselves together in death, end quote.
Wow.
Problem is, Marjorie's not dead.
Yeah.
Only Wally.
Yep.
And so they do an autopsy and find that Wally actually died from a drug overdose, even though she tried to do the whole gas thing.
Sure.
So they're thinking it's a murder-suicide. She didn't follow through with her side of it.
Right.
And the charges are dropped.
Ugh.
And Wally's three children want their dad's body returned to Minnesota to be buried next to their mother.
Yeah.
But Marjorie, from her prison cell, refuses to release it. And after a long, costly legal battle, a judge granted the children half of his ashes. Marjorie got the other half.
This is just bizarre.
And that's when the Hagen family publicly comes forward and says, we think Marjorie was involved in our mom's death, too.
Mm.
Well, you know what? So do I.
Yeah.
In 2001, it's time for Marjorie's parole hearing. Two of Wally's children attend. It's in Phoenix, Arizona. Marjorie walks in a bright orange jumpsuit. She wants early release. She takes no responsibility for her actions. She ranted to the board, to the parole board, about how Wally's kids were there and had caused her so much trouble over the years. But at the same time, several of Marjorie's kids had written letters to the parole board saying, Don't let her out early.
Yeah.
Your own children are writing to the parole board saying, don't let mom out.
Yeah, yeah.
So the ruling is no early parole.
Wow.
In 2004, having served a decade in prison, Marjorie moved to Tucson. She's finally released. She's out. In 2007, Marjorie befriends a man named Roger Samus. Okay. He's in an assisted living home, and she offered to help with his finances. So he signs over power of attorney so she can pay his bills. Soon, he is dead.
Yeah.
But she kept writing checks to herself. Police tried to determine if his cause of death had anything to do with Marjorie. But Marjorie used her power of attorney to have him cremated right away. She was charged with fraud and forgery and sentenced to intensive probation. I have no idea what that means.
Whatever.
3 years later, Marjorie goes to court to try to get out of her probation so she could move into an assisted living facility.
Okay.
And the judge denies her request.
Wow.
And in fact, the assisted living place was like, yeah, go sell crazy someplace else, Marjorie, because we don't want you living here.
Yeah, they're like,
yeah, we're done. We don't need you here. And she was mad about that. She wanted to sue him. And the court was like, too bad.
Wow.
In 2016, she buys a house in Tucson. Then I guess she moved to Phoenix in a condominium development where her neighbors are afraid of her. Like, I read one story where this young reporter decides she's going to go find Marjorie, and she gets to this condo development, and she talks to some of the neighbors, and they won't really talk about Marjorie because they know she's been known to set fires.
Wow.
And her family has pretty much disowned her. She doesn't give interviews. She's lived under a few different aliases. And I believe she is still alive.
Wow.
And if she is, she is 91 years young. I did read where Velma, the nurse, her family sued the Congdon trustees for failing to provide adequate security that night. I think her family received a settlement of $225,000. I've read an interview with Marjorie's daughter, with one of her kids, who just basically says she's lived under a bunch of aliases. None of us really have anything to do with her. And if she's living under an alias, because I couldn't find whether or not she had passed away.
Right.
So that's why I said if she is alive, she's 91.
Right.
But that is the mystery of the Congdon murders. That's all I have to say about that. Hey, Hitch to Homicide listeners. The wait is over. If you're a reader or a fan of my Sex and Lies series, Book 10, Sex, Lies, and Rock and Roll is now available on Amazon. With a successful tour and 2 years of sobriety under his belt, rock star Noah Hart is ready to put his secrets and the past behind him. That is, until his former bandmates and business partners are murdered one by one, and suddenly he becomes the prime suspect. When FBI agent Louisa Hathaway is assigned to the case, no one, including her partner, is aware she carries her own secrets, including an undeniable infatuation with rock and roll's bad boy, Noah Hart. As the body count rises, Agent Hathaway is torn between unraveling the truth and falling for the man who might be the killer. Don't miss this new book, Sex, Lies, and Rock and Roll, by me, Chris Calvert. Only on Amazon. Rock and roll will never die, but it might kill you.
You know, only a psychopath could start with a multi-billion dollar family and end up living in a van down by the river.
It's true.
Wow.
It's true. So she's never been, you know, everybody thinks Marjorie had something to do with her mother's death.
Sure.
Obviously.
Right.
And what I didn't cover after I told you I would talk about the DNA is that years later, they tested the envelope and it was Roger's DNA on there.
Oh, was it?
It was Roger's DNA. Yeah.
So he left this world trying to still convince everybody it wasn't him.
Yes. Yes. But I mean, obviously it was him. He had the swollen hand. Yeah. He had the cuts, you know, from fighting off Velma.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
But then he commits suicide and says in his suicide note, I didn't do it.
Yeah. Wow.
But he never implicates Marjorie.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't too bright, let's face it.
Well, he thought he was getting $2.5 million of her $8
million. Yeah, yeah.
And that was the end of that.
Yeah, well. Well, speaking of not bright, let's move off from that and go to a little bless your heart. All right, well, let's start with number one here, and I'm calling this, I'm terrible at kids' games.
Okay.
A policeman responding to a burglary report at a house in Johannesburg sat down on a couch to take a statement, not realizing a burglar was hiding underneath of it. The homeowner looked down and saw the burglar lying flat on his stomach, half under and behind the couch.
His head, he's still in the house?
His head was right near the policeman's legs. The policeman jumped off the couch and the man was arrested after handing back the stolen jewelry and a digital camera.
Oops.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to do my best South African accent right
okay.
now.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
All right. Quote, the police were so chuffed. They were in seventh heaven that they caught him. The whole thing was so bizarre, the homeowner told the Star newspaper.
Just chuffed a bit.
They were chuffed.
Chuffed a bit. Just excited, just so happy. Chuffed a bit.
I actually had to look that word up because I had never heard chuffed before.
Oh, I've heard chuffed a bit a lot.
No, never have. So anyway. Okay, number two. You know, they may be very low, but I do have standards.
Okay.
One local thief had high standards, but poor follow through. When Wellington Silva Oliveira robbed a cook, I love that name, robbed a cook taking his wallet and watch, he was upset to find the watch wasn't quite what he wanted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he kept the money, but he returned the watch claiming it was a fake.
Was it like a fake Rolex or something?
Who knows? While the victim hurried to report the mugging to the police, Oliveira stopped by to play soccer at a nearby field where he was still playing when police arrived and arrested him.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Bless his heart. Bless his heart. Well,
I know. Imagine, you know, the crook hands the watch back to you and says, I don't want this.
This isn't good enough. This is a fake. I don't want this.
All right. All right.
Do better, cook. Yeah. Do better.
All right. Number three. I don't have an ending to this, but I just thought it was funny. Surprise. One thief got more than he bargained for when he reached into a window of a parked car and snatched a tote. The bag belonged to professional snake catcher Brad McDonald. Inside was a highly venomous snake McDonald had just captured from an underground car park in Sydney. Gotcha!
That is priceless.
Karma's a bitch.
Karma is a bitch. Oh my gosh, a snake. That's great. So, I love it.
So there's your bless your hearts.
Well, if you have a bless your heart or you know somebody's heart who needs blessing.
Yes.
Go to hitchtohomicide.com. There's a pull-down menu where you can also suggest a case.
Yes.
Just like this one was suggested today.
Right.
That's all we have today. That's my amazing husband out there.
And that's my beautiful bride in the booth.
With Scotty.
Yes.
Join us next time on Hitch to Homicide.
Bye, y'all.